My guest is a writer, historian, minister and honorary fellow in the Department of Ancient History at Macquarie Uni. He's also co-founder and director of the Centre for Public Christianity. That's a media company seeking to promote the public understanding of the Christian faith. He's also a senior minister of St. Andrew's in Roseville. Somehow, he has time to talk. John Dixon, good morning.
Great to talk with you.
You too. You're a busy fella.
Yeah, it's all smoke and mirrors.
Well, I was going to mention that, but I didn't want to offend you immediately.
You know, I have great colleagues in all the places I work, and, you know, that's how it works.
That's the key. Surround yourself with good ones.
Yep.
Listen, I'm curious, first up, what gave you a fascination for ancient history? I mean, I have one, so I want to ask you now, because I really enjoyed your documentary you made some years ago. Israel.
Yeah. Well, look, I put it down to an overactive imagination.
Yeah.
I found myself, when I was doing New Testament studies at Moore College, always my mind would drift to think about what life was like in ancient Rome. So we might be studying a letter of Paul to the Romans,
yeah,
and I'd find myself thinking, I wonder what living under the emperor was like in those days. And and so it's that imaginative aspect that made me sort of enjoy thinking both about the text of Scripture, but also about the context in which Scripture was written.
Mm.
And when I finished my studies in theology, I enrolled in a master's, and the master's blew out into a PhD that was far more historical. So I transferred over to Macquarie University, which has a first-rate ancient history department. And so that's where I did my doctoral studies. But I think it comes down to imagination.
Yeah.
I love to think about what it was like to live in Corinth.
What
was it like in first century Jerusalem?
And then you had the pleasure of spending time in the Middle East.
Yeah.
How did that enhance your imagination?
Well, I mean, that was just, I was a kid in a candy shop.
Yeah.
For when I shot the Christ Files and the Life of Jesus, I got to visit these places and interview scholars and sit in archaeological digs that I'd only read about in books.
Mm.
But, you know, here I was able to stand in some places, the earliest church ever found, for example, in the middle of Israel is a beautiful old villa that Christians used to meet in. And there are inscriptions on the floor in honor of Jesus Christ. And to stand there, where believers 1,800 years ago had stood, was really a highlight of my life.
Let's talk about a recent outing you had last week, a conference. You said that the biggest problems for Christians is ego. What do you mean by that?
Well, I know myself.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not really pointing a finger at anyone else.
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to put my hand up too.
Yeah, yeah. So it seems to me that Christians, some Christians appear to our skeptical friends in the public as bullies, legislative bullies, religious bullies, spiritual bullies, moral bullies. And although, you know, you and I would say, we don't ever intend to be like a bully, sometimes the things we say get interpreted that way.
Mm.
And bullies don't get a hearing in the playground. And I just... I really feel the only solution is for us to really think seriously about the humility that Christ embodied.
Yeah.
He had a powerful conviction, of course. I'm not talking about being a little mouse in the corner, but he was the first to sit down with the sinners and tax collectors and show them friendship and love.
Good point. Let's talk about your latest book. This is number, can you remember?
Look, honestly, I don't know. I should, for future radio interviews, go and count them all.
Okay.
I know it's more than a dozen and less than 20.
Wow. Okay, let's say it's a baker's dozen. Maybe it's 13. What inspired you to write The Doubter's Guide to the Bible?
Well, ever since I've been a Christian, about 16 years of age, I felt a great sympathy with doubters.
Mm.
And I think this is partly because I came from a home that had no Christian faith at all.
Really? So and yet, I'll jump in there, somehow it's produced two pastors. I know your brother, so wow, yeah. What a great outcome.
Yeah, my mum is still shocked.
Yeah.
she once said, one minister son is interesting, two is careless. So yeah, I'd never been inside a church before I was 16.
Wow.
And so I've always felt this kind of kinship with those who don't believe. I get why they don't believe.
Mm.
And partly because I'm a doubting personality. There's hardly anything I believe today that I haven't really doubted at some point. And so it's out of that sympathy for doubters and skeptics that a lot of my writing career has focused on the questions people ask, you know, whether it's something like If I Were God, I'd End All the Pain, the book from years ago, or, you know, The Christ Files is all about historical doubts people have about Jesus. And The Doubter's Guide to the Bible tries to do something that's a little over-ambitious, talk about ego. I try to take the reader from Genesis to Revelation in just 200 pages and deal with the doubts that our friends might have. So it's actually not a book written directly for Christians. It's actually a book written directly for those who don't think of themselves as Christians, who have too many questions about the Bible. And I'm trying to show them how this narrative from Genesis to Revelation answers our most profound longings as human beings.
Mm. You can never assume faith. There's always a strong argument against it, isn't there?
Yeah. Skeptics and atheists aren't all idiots. I mean, they have reasons. Now, some of the reasons are better than others. I don't think every argument of, say, Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, is a quality argument. But he has some good arguments. And I want to feel the force of those arguments before I try and offer a response. In fact, it's probably true to say, unless you feel the force of the argument, you probably haven't understood it.
Yeah. John Dixon's our special guest this morning. He's written a new book, A Doubter's Guide to the Bible. I don't often talk about formats of book, but I will this time because I like it. It's kind of small. It's almost sort of handbook size. Was that a decision you made?
It was a decision the publisher made at Zondervan. So, I always go with what they think. They're very wise in these.
It's good because you can almost, you know, take it with you and maybe if you've got a pocket large enough, slide it in the back.
Yeah, it's a nice little design. I agree.
So I want to talk about the other day I stumbled across something interesting from you where you connected Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon to the Bible. I'm going to play it to you.
Well, if you think of it in terms of refraction, here's my Pink Floyd t-shirt to help us out. Scientists tell us that when light passes through a prism, it refracts on the other side. It breaks into the full spectrum of light.
Now, I happen to appreciate Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, and I've never really heard it connect to the Bible. So how did you do that? What do you mean?
Great album, right?
Yeah, classic.
How do I connect it? What I'm trying to describe there is the Old Testament and how it relates to the New Testament. Because you sometimes, one of the doubts our friends might put to us is, how come you're picking and choosing? There are all these Old Testament things that are a bit creepy that you don't follow, so why should I follow anything? What's your rhyme and reason for picking this command and not that one?
Right.
And the simple answer is, from the beginning, Christians have seen the Old Testament as like a light that had to pass through the prism of Jesus Christ. And just as light refracts, breaks into the full spectrum on the other side of a prism, so the New Covenant, because of Jesus' teaching and death and resurrection, it refracts the Old Testament light. Now, some things in the Old Testament are changed very little, like care for the poor in the Old Testament. It's care for the poor in the New. But some things are dramatically changed, like circumcision is now fulfilled in Jesus Christ. The food laws are now fulfilled in Jesus Christ. Some things are even intensified in the New Testament. So love your neighbor is an Old Testament command. But Jesus took that to the extreme and said you're to love your enemy, that neighbor includes enemy. Yeah. And all of these are examples of what I call refraction. This is not Christians picking and choosing. It's what the Old Testament always said would happen. A new covenant would come, and it would transform that old covenant. And Jesus himself taught that he brought the new covenant, which changed the way we read the Old Testament. So now Christian can read the Old Testament without understanding how Jesus has refracted the light of the Old Covenant.
It's a good take. Clever stuff. John Dixon's with us. How can we be effective in nurturing believers whilst reaching out to others who may be simply curious about Christianity?
Well, I mean, in a way, my book is trying to do both. In that I suspect the average believer will pick up my book and feel... I'm hoping they'll feel that the whole thing hangs together more beautifully, more coherently than they even suspected as a believer. And that is incredibly nourishing to our faith. It isn't really about the historical proof for this or the rational argument for that. it's really about how does this whole narrative from creation to new creation via Jesus hold together, and more than that, explain the world that we find ourselves living in.
Mm.
And so when Christians see that for themselves, they're incredibly encouraged. But for those who aren't yet Christians, the same message, exactly the same message, can be incredibly alluring, drawing, because so many of us long for a macro story, a story that explains everything.
Yeah.
I love that C.S. Lewis quote where he said, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it, I see everything else.
Mm.
And I think of the Bible like that. It's like the great sun that has risen, S-U-N. And it's not just that you can look at the sun and feel its warmth. The thing is, by the sun, you can look at everything else. It lights up everything. And I think the biblical narrative lights up human nature, human history, our deepest longings.
John, I'd love to know, what are some of the challenges in making Christian-based media that we face each day that engages with all comers? How do we leap over those challenges so that we can, you know, begin to go beyond just preaching to the converted, but to make the media we present totally inclusive?
I genuinely think that this sympathy for those who don't believe is crucial. So that when a person who doesn't really think there's strong evidence for Christianity or maybe has been hurt by Christians turns on your radio station,
yeah,
what they hear is not a kind of preachy, dogmatic version of the faith, but one that is firm in conviction, of course, but full of compassion. And this is the thing that I think Jesus was the genius at. He had massively strong convictions about sin, about life and death, about the coming judgment, but he was also incredibly compassionate. He could flex both muscles at the same time, if I can put it like that.
Yeah.
He could flex the muscle of conviction and then sit down with the sinners at the dinner table and convey his compassion to them. And in a sense, Christians throughout history have broken those two things apart. They've either been all conviction and no compassion, or they've been all compassion and no conviction. And both is a mistake. Both sort of miss what Jesus was about. He was about incredible conviction and striking compassion. And so I think for media, whether it's the Center for Public Christianity or your radio station, if we can somehow have firm conviction and strong compassion, I think that's the formula that reflects Jesus best.
Do you think the recent story is happening right now of the Bali 9-2 opens up opportunities for hope to be presented in a broader media market?
Well, I would hope so. I know Simon Smart did a radio interview just this morning on that very topic, because we're also disturbed by what's happening to those two.
Mm.
And yet, at least in the case of Andrew Chang, there's a faith story to tell.
Yeah.
He's come to have a very firm faith. And so it would just be wonderful if more people, on the one hand, think about the most important things in life. Any death story causes you to think about the most important things. It concentrates the mind. But on the other hand, hear the story of Andrew Chan in a way that will hopefully open up more possibilities to talk about Christ.
John, thanks for your time. You don't just write words. He also puts words to music. So finally, what might be ahead for your music? I know in the past you've put a few things out and played a few shows along the way. What have you got there in your back pocket?
Well, I do have a few things in my back pocket. I wrote a bunch of songs just as we were finishing up professionally recording that I never had a chance to record. And I've worked on them over the years. And there are some half-decent songs that I'm thinking of recording in the future. But we'll see.
Will that be In the Silence or will this be solo John Dixon?
This will either be John Dixon with Ben Shaw, the guitarist from In the Silence. He and I did a couple of duo albums after the band.
Yeah.
And he and I occasionally do stuff. So he's in London now, but whenever I go to London, he gets a session band together and we do a concert.
Right.
So it's more likely to be John and Ben. I'm just going to record them as demos and give them to other producers so that other people can sing them, because I'm the nerdy uncle now, not the young singer.
John, thank you so much. A Doubter's Guide to the Bible. It's at a lot of good bookstores right now and wonderful truck stops around the nation, as they used to say. John Dixon, thanks for your time.
Absolute pleasure.